Okay, right, I assume everyone can hear me properly. So this is the title of this is 10 Ways That Socialism Can Heal the Earth. And I've got to apologise immediately that this is rather an ambitious title. But before I get to that, I just want to share with you a fascinating fact that I found out just the other day about a thing called the Wilkes negative gravity anomaly. And you might not never have heard of this. I hadn't. This is a 300 mile wide area under miles of ice in southeast Antarctica, and it's thought to be an impact crater from an asteroid possibly five times bigger than the Chicxulub asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs along with 76% of species. Now, this Wilkes crater is just about the right age to be the possible smoking asteroid behind the Permian-Triassic extinction 250 million years ago, which killed 90% of all life on the planet. So there we are. I thought that was an interesting fact that I just found out the other day. It's tangentially connected to tonight's talk, somewhat contrived fashion. As I speak, 150 species are going extinct every day. That's 55,000 a year. One in four species on the planet currently face extinction, and that's expected to rise to one in two in the next 75 years. 90% of oceanic species are also facing extinction in the next 75 years. Humans are just 0.01% of all life on Earth, but have managed to destroy 83% of wild mammals. In geological terms and on some metrics, then, capitalism is set to be the biggest asteroid to hit the Earth in 65 million years, if not in 250 million years. Well, this isn't a talk about how bad capitalism is, it's a talk about the ways that socialism can heal the Earth. I wanted to put a number on it, so I randomly chose 10. But really, I could have picked any number, because once you eliminate the market and the profit motive, the possibilities really kind of spiral off the charts. And I've reluctantly come to the conclusion that I'm going to have to do this talk in several parts, just because too many stats and facts all at once. It's just going to take too long, and anyway, it's going to pulverize your brain. So this is part one. But even so, a lot of the solutions can be categorised together under one basic heading, which is stop doing destructive shit. A lot of stuff can be fixed simply by just not doing stuff anymore that capitalism insists on doing. Simply desist and let the world repair itself. So in my list of 10, and I warn you, I'm not going to get very far through this list of 10, but my list of 10, number one is a general point, which is this: use common sense. Now, that means picking all round best solutions instead of those that the market chooses. It means not wasting resources on pointless activities. You can think of plenty in capitalism. I particularly like Bitcoin as a supremely pointless activity. Each Bitcoin transaction uses one swimming pool's worth of water. Other pointless activities: keeping city centres lit all night, or people in Stockport commuting to work in Liverpool, while people living in Liverpool commute to work in Stockport, this sort of thing. In fact, the entire and gigantic structural waste of capitalism that is so big that it would take a talk all by itself. And that's just not the structural waste of banking and insurance. That's also dwarfed by the number employed in often pretty useless services or manufacturing often useless goods. And common sense also means focusing on the priorities. And here I'd like to quote Hannah Ritchie, who is an editor of Our World in Data, and who's just written a new book, Not the End of the World, where she's kind of talking up the, you know, the good aspects of what are going on, without diminishing the bad aspects. Now, she talks about the need to focus on priorities, I'll quote her now. She says, for example, there's a tendency in rich countries to hype behaviours that have little real impact, such as recycling, ensuring televisions are not left on standby mode, while continuing to drive, fly and eat meat. If everyone in Europe stopped using plastics tomorrow, the world's oceans would hardly notice the difference. Palm oil, the sworn enemy of environmental defenders, is an insanely productive plant that generates far more oil per hectare of land than alternatives like soybean and coconut. Synthetic fertilizers, another target of environmental movements, were essential to grow the food that sustains half the world's population. The reality is that the world cannot go organic. Too many of us rely on fertilizers to survive. Hannah Ritchie is also a fan of GMO, surprise, surprise, and nuclear power, which brings me to another common sense requirement to close this section. Be open-minded because you might not like some of the solutions. Okay, now I'm going to move on to section two, which has to be the environment, the biggest global problem at the moment, apart from perhaps nuclear war. And global warming is the first thing, you know, we have to look at. Now, lots of us have noted that the narrative on this has changed quite significantly over the years. It feels as if it's been hijacked by vested interests, including the fossil fuel lobby, so that global warming has become a finger to point at you, the individual, instead of capitalist society and particularly capitalist production. Well, in socialism, of course, you, the individual, will be expected to take your responsibility, but as well as the society as a whole, and not instead of. I have a chart to show a breakdown of global emissions. Let me see if I can find it a second. If I can't, never mind. Just hold on 1 second. I've got too many windows open. Okay, greenhouse gas emissions. Let me see if I can just share that screen. If I'm allowed to share. Okay. That's... Okay, so you can see from that, I think I'm showing the wrong screen. Just hold on, right? That's the wrong chart. That's clever, isn't it? The trouble is both of these charts look very similar. No, that's the wrong one. Actually, I'm going to just forget that. You don't really need to look at a lot of charts, so... let's just ignore that. Sorry. The bottom line is electricity and heat are the biggest contributors to global emissions, followed by transport, followed by manufacturing and construction, followed by agriculture. So what is socialism going to do about this? Well, it needs to decarbonize all of these. I mean, capitalism is making efforts to do this, of course, and socialism would have to continue. We would also consider how much of each of these are actually necessary. I just point you towards personal consumption, use of personal private cars, for example. We would have to start reversing trends by, one way is to take carbon back out of the atmosphere through carbon capture and storage. Now, at the moment, that's a small-scale horizon tech, too expensive to develop under capitalist market conditions. But socialism might have better luck. Another proposal is geoengineering, which at the moment is regarded as a last resort, and a way to give global emitters an alibi to carry on emitting. But it might be a possibility in socialism, because unlike capitalism, you know, we will be able to globally cooperate to get emissions down. We don't have any kind of sectarian competition to think about or any trade figures to worry about. the next part of the environment is species extinction, which I've alluded to already. What would we do? We could start restoring and rewilding habitats. We could relocalize farming and move away from big ag monocropping, which I'll mention again in a minute. I suggest we stop ocean floor trawling. We could expand existing gene banks for endangered species. Some zoos already do that. They have things called frozen zoos. And we could also, because we don't have markets, we can also not worry about poor people being forced to poach game for a living or destroy rare forest. So a lot of these things, the solution is the same as we understand it. Once you take money and the market out of the equation, a lot of these things will just stop happening by themselves. It isn't anything that we actually have to do. But there will be things we have to do, of course. If you look at something, I looked at air pollution. This is absolutely massive. You never really think about it in a developed country. But 7 million people die of air pollution every year. That's 2,000 children every day. 99% of people on the planet breathe air that exceeds WHO guideline limits for pollution. Now, a lot of that is due to fossil fuels, private transport, and industry and manufacturing. But capitalism creates huge problems that we wouldn't have because they're interested in making a profit. They're not interested in the externalities. We would be able to do things without having to work out how to make a profit out of it, how to attract green investors, billionaire philanthropists, how to make dubious carbon credit systems work, or how to stop backdoor cheats like shipping all your pollution to poor countries. There's lots more I could say on this, but I can't be all night, so I'm going to move on to section item three, which is food and water. The situation with food has improved. Not as many people starve to death nowadays as did 20 years ago, but there are still 25,000 people starving to death every day. Mostly this is in war-torn sub-Saharan countries like Chad and Sudan. That doesn't mean there's no food in these places. If you try Googling best restaurants in Khartoum, you get an instant list of the top restaurants. You could get a list of the top 100 restaurants. You soon realise it's only lack of money that's the problem. People aren't starving because there's no food. Then there's water. 700 million don't have access to clean water, and 3.5 million die every year from water-related diseases. And 1.5 billion people, a lot of them in India, don't have their own toilet. So what would we do? So the first solution, as I said before, is something that we don't have to do, we just stop doing, which is we stop maintaining the artificial scarcity imposed by capital to keep prices high and profits steep, which often involves destroying food as well. So in many cases, we would have food surpluses as a result, so it becomes a distribution problem rather than a food problem. The problem with clean water could be we could have solar-powered filtration and desalination plants or more pipelines, things that at the moment you have to find investors to invest in. Well, they're not going to invest if these things are going to poor people in places that don't have much money. So again, things we don't have to worry about, we could just get on with. And if we can't move food and water to people, there's nothing to say that we couldn't move the people to the food and water. There's potentially no shortage of space in the world. If you just take Britain for an example, one of the most densely populated areas in the world outside Hong Kong is Britain. And if you ask most people in Britain how much of British land is urbanised, people will generally tell you, well, probably about half of it. In fact, only 0.1% of land in Britain is what's called continuous urban fabric, and only 5.4% is considered urban at all. And then you just think of the vastly underpopulated USA, Canada, lots of places around the world. And at the rate the world is warming, even places like Greenland and West Antarctica could become habitable. As a matter of fact, you can also grow green veg. You can already grow green vegetables, cabbages and spuds and things in South Greenland. I mentioned that Hannah Ritchie said that eating organic won't work. One of the reasons is because it takes up too much land. This is the thing about palm oil. Palm oil is everyone's bad boy, but it actually takes less land than any other oil-producing crop. A recent Paris study also found that sustainable nitrogen-free organic farming would only feed 3 billion people on the planet, or it could feed up to 14 billion depending on the degree to which meat and dairy farming were reduced. Even for a non-organic Western style diet with 55% meat protein, a 9 billion population would require extra land the size of Russia. As things stand, the world can't really afford the meat and dairy industry. Only 16% of agricultural land is used for human food crops and 80% for livestock. Now here I will try and show you a chart if I can, because this is quite informative. Okay, so I think you can see there at the top you've got the complete Earth surface, 29% land, 71% ocean. Of the land, 76% is habitable because the rest is barren or glaciers. Of the habitable, 45% is given to agriculture, 38% forests. And can you see next to where it says 13% shrub, you've got 1% urban and built up land. This reflects what I was saying a second ago about the UK. This is true of the world generally. 1% is urban and built up land. So there's potentially a lot of land. Now, of the 45% that's agricultural, that's used for agriculture, see how much underneath is used for meat and dairy and textiles, 80%, and only 16% used for crops for food. Okay, that's enough of that chart. So you get the idea. And we know that protein conversion ratios are hugely wasteful. So, you know, 1 kilo of vegetable protein, or 3 kilos of vegetable protein, produces approximately 1 kilo of meat protein. That's more or less, give or take, the sort of ratio you're talking about. It's also the same is true as fish farming, by the way. It's a net consumer of protein, not a producer. I know it's capitalism is making efforts to make us eat insects. Well, I can't see that having much support in capitalism, probably not in socialism either. But the good news is that cultured alternatives are making a bit of a thing. They save ridiculous amounts of land and water, and lab-grown dairy milk, basically grown in the lab, it's really easy to scale up, much easier than lab meat. Just the other day, New Scientist had a podcast item about making butter out of coal, or at least carbon. Apparently it's quite an old technology. Something we need to do is something about the monocropping problem. There's 14,000 nutritious plant species we could eat, but 75% of the food we eat comes from 12 plants and 5 animals. And only 30 plants fuel the calories that we consume globally, and of those, 60% come from just 3 staple crops, which are all grasses, rice, wheat and corn. So the disease and pest risk from monocropping is pretty obvious. What we need to do, what socialism would, I think, do, is diversify as fast as possible. We could use the seeds from the Svalbard Global Seed Vault to diversify seed stocks in a couple of seasons. I have to say something about food waste while we're at it, because 30% of food is wasted. a lot of that, a lot of the food for animal crops is and fuels is essentially food that people could have eaten. 60% of European wheat is fed to animals, 23% of palm oil goes for diesel, 40% of US maize goes for car fuel. But there's a lot more waste because crops harvest all at once, and local farmers don't have refrigeration systems, or they don't have the ability to preserve stuff in plastic. So plastic wraps can reduce food waste by 75%. Remember what Hannah Ritchie said about if all Europeans stopped using plastic, the oceans wouldn't even notice a difference. Stupidly, though, as well, producers in the West also discard around 20% of food for cosmetic reasons. So user expectations are going to have to change. Well, that's if people are cooking for shopping and cooking for themselves. But that begs the question, why would they do that in socialism? And now I come on to a big point, I think, a big resource-saving point. 61% of food waste is from residential households, but local restaurants and cafes waste 26%, quite a lot less. Now, it seems to me that we could make big savings on food waste, as well as energy, using communal cafes and refectories. The more we do things communally, as in communism, the more there's going to be an economy of scale. I mentioned monocropping, but industrial farming itself is the most profitable way to do farming in capitalism, but it's responsible for habitat loss, it's responsible for massive loss of hedgerows in Britain, and it's the main driver of forest loss. It's caused 70 to 80% of tropical deforestation. Soya crops are partly responsible. Soya has increased from 30 million tonnes in the 1960s to 350 million. I had a nice little chart that showed what that gets used on, but you can just take my word for it that around 80% of that soya is used for animal feed and biofuels. Hardly any of it, tiny amount, is used for actual direct human food, tofu and whatnot. So don't blame us tofu munchers. And by the way, if you're using soya milk at home, or coconut milk or almond milk, well, they're tropical crops. So try using oat milk, because it doesn't curdle in coffee, and you can grow oats in Scotland. So I mentioned that industrial farming is about the most profitable way of doing it. It is, but it's in the UK, for example, it's about what you can get a combine harvester over. So anything else is unprofitable in capitalist terms. Now, you will know very well that Britain is a very hilly place, and so a lot of it is not used for crops simply because it's too hilly for combine harvesters. But unprofitable doesn't mean unproductive. We could massively increase output in just a small place like Britain by going small scale with terracing, strip farming, polytunnels, forest multi-level crops. It'd be much more labour intensive, but labour is one thing that socialism doesn't have to worry about. We'll have plenty of labour because all the useless jobs of capitalism will have been abolished. Then we look at, I'll mention fishing. You don't need fish, and we need the oceans to recover. Since 1950, the human population has increased by 175%. Fishing has increased by 750%. What's the result? Fish populations have crashed by up to 90%. And when the Deepwater Horizon spill happened in 2010, and all fishing in the area was stopped, fish populations actually recovered despite all the oil. Then there's where does all the food get produced? Countries are going to have to produce food locally as much as they can. 75% of food in Britain is locally produced, but you have the problem of cash crops like rice, coffee, tea, cocoa, sugar, corn. this might be a regional problem, to say nothing of Mediterranean vegetables, oils and wines. I mean, it's not just the distribution problem. Farmers won't be growing cash crops for sale when there's no market. They'll be growing stuff they can use locally. Ultimately, food producers are going to want to think about providing surpluses for a global common store on the basis of from each according to ability. How this might work in the short term, you know, could be something for us to discuss. We're anyway talking, initially at least, about sustainable sufficiency rather than any kind of putative global abundance. Perhaps a gauge of socialist consciousness might be asking people if they agree that it's more important to stop 25,000 people starving to death every day than it is that they can get their morning coffee and chocolate biscuit. And just to conclude the food section, let's not forget that populations fall the more stable the society. And in fact, they're falling right now in capitalism. Some estimates see it falling as low as 4 billion by the end of the century. That's a real problem for capitalism because, of course, human labour is the source of all profits. But it's not a problem for socialism. We would simply cut our coat according to our cloth, as it were. And if we have a low population, well, we can develop more automation, robots and AI if need be. Okay, moving on to the next section, which is going to be the last section I'm going to deal with today, you'll be happy to hear, which is energy. Again, I can't say a huge amount about this, but it's an interesting subject. So first of all, renewables, well, they're great, but they're still only 30% of the global mix. They're also intermittent and they require a lot of land. Solar panels are actually now cheaper than fencing, but mounting them on roofs is 50% less efficient than in solar farms. And the UK is the one country in the world, I heard the other day, that could never be self-sufficient in solar. That just proves how rubbish our weather is. Solar isn't as green as people make out either. There are no plans for how to recycle end-of-life solar panels, and they contain toxic lead, cadmium and chromium. But overall, the intermittency problem of renewables, there are loads of people working on different types of batteries. You could have big sodium battery farms or water batteries where you pump water up a slope and then let it go down again where possible. So there are lots of solutions being worked on in capitalism, but of course in capitalism you always have to worry about what will pay, what's economic, what's not economic, this sort of thing, things that we wouldn't have to worry about. Wind farms, there's a lot of talk about wind farms, getting lots more offshore wind farms. The problem with them is that each of the propellers has got a massive gearbox behind it, and these can get stripped. They need replacing every so often, and someone has to climb up these bloody things, which means that wind farms, according to one source I saw, cause more deaths than nuclear plants, as basically people get blown off or fall off. And having wind farms out to sea, of course, you've got to also have long and very lossy cabling. So the upshot there is that there is no magic bullet for energy. Hydrogen, another good option for heavy trucks, particularly industrial blast furnaces, but probably not for small transport or domestic uses, apart from which there's no infrastructure there. Heat pumps, not particularly efficient. Geothermal's good, but only available in some places, same as hydro and tidal. So the energy mix is going to depend on the area. There's no one-size-fits-all solution when fossils off the table. I feel I ought to mention nuclear power. With nuclear fusion forever decades away, we could consider expanding nuclear fission. This has always had a bad press since the 80s and Chernobyl, but proponents say that it's a bit like air travel. It's nearly always safe, it just looks very bad when there's an accident. It's fairly cheap to produce. France produces one-tenth the carbon emissions of Germany per capita at half the cost. this would have to be a debate. I'm not going to go too much into nuclear. There would have to be a debate about it. The waste problem applies to pressurized water reactors and advanced gas cool reactors, which produce a lot of low-level waste. But all this waste could be fed into fast breeders and recycled into plutonium and stuff, which produces a very tiny amount of waste, but it is extremely toxic waste. So pros and cons there. It would depend what situation socialism inherited as to whether this would be considered an option or perhaps the least worst option. And, you know, arguably we would have said the same about fracking if that was still a thing then, if renewables are not sufficiently developed. So other things, passenger cars and air travel, way more expensive than rail and passenger ferries. Capitalism, of course, as we know, is very fixated on personal consumption. It wants to sell us each our own ABC, our own toys, our own ability to get about. That's why it's putting its efforts into electric vehicles. It's a bit odd, really, because there are synthetic fuels in development, particularly for airplanes, but also I think Porsche is working on a synthetic fuel for Formula One. But more work could have been done in synthetic fuels, and then you could have used the world's existing stock of internal combustion engine cars, you know, without building any new factories or battery plants or any of this. You could just use your old banger, just put a different non-fossil fuel in it. I think that's quite a persuasive argument. But overall, instead of accepting, as capitalism just assumes, that we're going to have an ever larger requirement of energy, quadrupling in the case for electricity, if we're talking about electric cars, I think socialism could start asking the opposite question. How can we de-energize? How can we reduce the energy that we use? One really good way that socialism could do that capitalism could never do is abolish the military. A single US Army division uses around 6,000 gallons of fuel a day. The Department of Defense is the world's largest institutional user of petroleum. If the global military were a country, it would be the fourth largest in carbon emissions between India and Russia. So we could abolish quite a lot of energy use at a stroke, because we wouldn't have wars, wouldn't be any property to fight over, etc. We could expand the slower options. I mentioned a minute ago that passenger cars and air travel are expensive, but rail and passenger ferries are less expensive. So you know, we could discuss a kind of retro Victorianism where everybody gets around on trains or trams or ferries. William Morris would love it. I wouldn't even exclude canal extensions. I mean, they were perfectly feasible in the days when factories needed regular supply but not necessarily fast supply. Nowadays, with the just-in-time delivery systems using motorways, it's very energy-intensive. Socialism, I don't see any reason why a steady state production system would need just-in-time delivery systems. It could work just very well with plodding canal supply systems or even airships, but that's a by the by. We might have to prioritize certain things like air travel for emergency medical and disaster relief teams. So probably not everybody flying around the world necessarily, unless we've got synthetic fuels. But also we have to have people to fly the planes and ground crews to maintain them and factories to build them and all this sort of thing. So these would all have to be socially decided agreements. Communalising whatever can be communalised, sharing whatever can be shared. I mentioned earlier about sharing cooking. I mean, it just makes no sense for, you know, 30 people in a street all to be cooking you know, separately on separate stoves, you've been using separate energy at 6 o'clock in the evening. Why not just have one big cafe doing a cook up 6 o'clock, and they all eat and help wash up and take turns? Just seems more sensible and more sociable. Heating apartments is cheaper than heating separate houses. And I know this has caused arguments on here before, but we don't all need separate washing machines, fridges, power tools, lawnmowers, etc. And reducing the need, the degree of online activity in favour of local participatory activity. I tried to find an update of that old saw about a Google search being, or two Google searches being equivalent to boiling a kettle. That's from 2008, so I don't know what it is now, but I do know that global server farms use an intense amount of energy for cooling and what have you. So that's another massive amount of energy being used that we could reduce just by, you know, reducing the amount of online activity that we do by working locally. This might have the added bonus of getting the kids off their phones and us out of Zoom meetings. Okay, so to conclude, I'm nearly done now. All of the above, I mean, it's all negotiable. And like I say, I'm sorry, I should have realized this was going to take more than one talk. So, you know, stand by for future installments in the fullness of time. So far, I've only really covered four areas and not even very well. I chose a subject sort of rather arbitrarily for the sake of something positive, but then I realized afterwards that it fits rather well with a project that some of us have got, which is to rewrite the Socialism as a Practical Alternative pamphlet for the 21st century. If you remember, it was written in the 1990s, before, pretty much before computers were even a thing, much less the World Wide Web. So probably there'll be a couple more installments of this, where I will be looking at, and the items I've got listed are: number 5, health; number 6, science; number 7, production and distribution; number 8, education; 9, housing; and 10, democracy. Okay, there you are. Those are the things I'm not going to talk about now. Over to you to discuss any of what I said already, or bring up any other points that occur to you, or tell me I'm talking out of my hat. I shall be cribbing notes off you all in a bid to plunder your ideas. So thank you very much.